social work. Social work has the power to change people's lives for the better. This podcast aims to help you learn, think, and act with integrity so people who need social work get help that will transform their lives. I'm Jo.
And I'm Jerry. So this is part one of our fifth podcast, the podcast for September 2017. We didn't do a podcast in August because of the summer break, so we're really pleased to be back. And we're also really excited that we've had getting on for 5,000 downloads of our various podcasts since we launched on iTunes and our new website in March this year. So we're really grateful to you for listening, and we would be even more grateful if people could let us know a bit more about what they think. So it's great that you're listening. Do tell us what you like and what you don't like, and you can either comment on our website, which is www.helpfulsocialwork.com, or you can leave a review on iTunes.
Sounds like a good thing, Jerry. Today, I'd really like us to talk about trust. Trust, when it's not misplaced, allows us to act wholeheartedly, and it really encourages us in our work. Trust depends on a confidence, I think, that you have something to offer and that you're able to deliver it. And that's what you mean by being an expert. People are able to trust that you can be helpful. And to act as an expert, it encompasses all the elements of really good interagency working. So you think about it, an expert have clear aims and proven methods to achieve this. They have a clear identity based on what they're able to do. They're in the right place and they've got sufficient authority to act. And they work appropriately with people who have complementary expertise. Social workers can claim expertise because they work skillfully day to day alongside people whose lives they claim to have knowledge about. And an expert is defined as someone who has knowledge and skills, but it comes from the word for experience. So our expertise comes from knowledge, skills, and experience. It's further enhanced by the values that dictate that this expertise is actually co-produced by the people that we work with. And I think this is really important, that we are in a knowledge exchange with people rather than setting ourselves up over the top of them.
Yeah, and that's the thing where, sorry, I just want to interrupt. That's where workers have something additional to offer compared to maybe an expert witness who would have great knowledge and skills but wouldn't necessarily know the people as well. So it's the experience of not knowing the family, of having a relationship with the family or with the child or with the adult, that bolsters the knowledge and skills expertise.
And also encourages the family, children and adults to think of themselves as having expertise and knowledge about themselves, because it can be very de-skilling to need help and to be putting yourself in expert hands, and they've got to be able to see themselves as part of the answer, part of the solution, and that they've got all this stuff to bring to the table as well. And I think that really helps us to use our power and use our expertise legitimately. And I think legitimacy is really important. It relies on transparency about our expertise and where it comes from. And if you think about the court situation, you need to be able to be really confident when you go in court that what you're saying and what you're relying on is factual and robust and helpful, and that you're presenting it in a way that is helpful both to the court and to the people you're working with. There was a judge who said that social workers acting as a witness in court can be judged to be an expert if they give an objective, independent, well-researched, thorough opinion, which takes an account of all the relevant information and represents their genuine professional view on issues submitted to them. And I think that's a really interesting point, their genuine professional view. I know when I've been in court, it's been very important for me to be able to own what it is I'm talking about and then to be able to demonstrate what I'm talking about with an example. I think that what is happening in this case is that the mother and the child have this issue in their relationship. The things that have made me think that are, and then talk about the different things I've seen. When I talked to mum about this, these were the things she said. And when I talked to the child about it, they were the things that they said about it. And these types of evidence-based conversations in court can be really helpful.
Yeah, and that does get around that issue that sometimes I hear from social workers, that they don't want to bring research into court because there's always counter research. But you bring in, this is my understanding It's informed by research, and these are the experience examples I have from knowing this particular situation. The experience defends your opinion about which knowledge is relevant. So yes, there might be counterexamples, but they're not the relevant ones in this particular situation. Does that make sense?
It's about how you make sense of observations. So you see something and you attribute a meaning to it, and then you have to ask yourself, well, what else could it mean? And then you need to say, well, what does evidence tell us about this kind of thing? And then you need to take it back and check it out with the family and the children. And if you've done all of that, then I think you can then present it in that form quite confidently in court.
Yeah.
So it's about, you know, being able to know where our knowledge and skills and experience come from and be confident in explaining them and using them ethically. So making sure that everyone has had access to our workings out.
Yeah, and that brings us completely into the idea of evidence-informed practice. So the fundamental characteristic of expert evidence is that it's opinion evidence. It's what someone's professional judgment, their opinion, their view of a situation is, rather than this is the absolute defined fact. You know, if it was something that there was one answer about, then anyone could find that answer. But it's one where you have to come to a view because it's not clear cut. And since we're using professional judgment, since we're using professional opinion, it's all the more ethically important and important for confidence and trust that we are really, really clear about where that view came from. And evidence-informed practice is a way of increasing the legitimacy of our opinion. So evidence-informed practice is using evidence to make good decisions in practice situations where, by definition, in a practice situation, there's uncertainty and lack of clarity. There isn't one answer. So what you're doing is you're coming to the best view possible using the best available evidence. And that evidence does include research evidence, but our research base in social work is not complete. We don't have research that says in these situations do this and this will always happen, because there's so many variables going on. So you want the research to give you really clear pointers about what might be happening, how you might explain it, what the impact might be and what you might do. But you also then need to triangulate that with both professional experience, practice experience, and service user views. So you're always using the best available evidence, which is research about what is likely to work, practice experience about what we know works in practice generally, and then the particular views of people about what they want, what helps them, and the particular views of the people involved in the work that you're doing, the situation that you're involved in at that moment. So you're applying expertise in an individual way always, so shaped by research and by practice experience, but really individual to that situation.
And I think that's it's really helpful as a team manager to be thinking about how to apply that in management oversight. Mm-hmm. So how you can actually be helpful in case discussions and use evidence in practice. So a worker comes to you and they say, can I talk to you about this case? Mm-hmm. And that normally they come to you with a kind of either a fixed problem or a fixed view. And they tell you their story. And I think it's the job of the team manager to explore that story well, mm-hmm. and to really help the practitioner think about what they don't know. And I think that's the real key to being helpful as a team manager. You're always trying to help your worker think, what don't you know? And so some of the questions that you can ask about a case can bring in evidence, bring in research. So you can ask them about, rather than asking just what's happening and what do you and other people think about it, you can also ask what research helps to explain what is happening, what theory helps to explain what is happening. And if they say to you, well, we haven't really looked at any, or I don't think there is any, then either together you can look, or you can, you know, point them to different places and ask them to have a really good look around and come back to you and make that discussion much richer. you know, really encourage the practitioner to use and find research and theory that relates to the situation and helps them think in a more wider way.
Yeah, and I think thinking about it as a going into the situation to listen to people's views and bring your expertise, your professional experience, your practice experience, and then stepping away from it and looking more broadly for research and theory that's relevant, and asking other people's opinions and looking more widely for service users' views, and then stepping back in to apply that to that particular situation. So it's almost like you get quite an intimate view, and then you get a much broader view, and then you come back to a conclusion.
Yeah, and in between that, of course, the very best thing to do is to pass any of that research and knowledge that you've acquired during that exploration back in to the family, child, young person that you're working with, so that they can play around with it, think about it, and think about their world from that point of view as well, because knowledge is very empowering, and the people we want to empower are the service users that we're working with.
Yeah, that brings me on to talking about knowledge exchange, actually, because if we do have confidence that we have expertise to offer, and if we do want people to trust it, then we have to be really open about it and share it. And that's also a way of growing the expertise. The more we debate it, test it out with other people and learn from them, the stronger and more robust it gets. And communities of practice provide quite a useful model for how professions, individuals, agencies can combine their expertise across boundaries to develop better practice. And they do that by transferring knowledge from one community of practice to another, or by exchanging knowledge between communities of practice. We did talk about communities of practice in an earlier podcast. We're talking about how social workers could come together to build community of practice around a shared goal, for example, child protection. But thinking about other groups that might have communities of practice around that kind of goal, you might, for example, have police officers, you might have teachers, you might have health visitors, you might have parents themselves who've got together in a group, you might have care leavers or children who are in a forum, a young people's forum, for example. And so one of the things we need to think about is how the knowledge that we hold in the social work community of practice can be exchanged and shared and strengthened by transferring, exchanging with other communities of practice. And the model of communities of practice that Benga developed shows how people can act as agents and use activities to cross the boundary and facilitate sharing. So it's really important that we keep our boundaries open. We're really transparent about our knowledge and our expertise, and that we're prepared to share that with others. And we're also looking for people that we can learn from, so that the community is constantly replenished and the knowledge is constantly strengthened.
Yeah, and that then gives us a role, the social work expert, a role as a knowledge broker, doesn't it? And so we can think about Conklin and his colleagues, where they talked about knowledge brokers helping the exchange of knowledge by creating relationships between people with shared goals, by promoting mutual understanding between these people, and facilitating the exchange of knowledge across those boundaries. There's also, you know, facilitating social interaction to support knowledge exchange, developing people's capacity to work together to create, find, and use and share knowledge. And that's all sorts of groups of people. And, you know, helping people overcome the barriers that really impact on their ability to exchange that knowledge. I think social workers are in a really good position to undertake this role, model it for others, and promote it. And one of the things that comes to mind is family group conferencing does that in a way, Jerry, when it gets together all the different members of a family who perhaps have never shared their own knowledge and expertise about the child and the situation in their family with each other at all. And the social worker acts as a mediator to help them have those conversations. And that they're a knowledge broker in that circumstance. You know, social work skills of building relationships, empathizing, communicating, and interpreting are really essential for good knowledge transfer and exchange.
So hopefully it's given some ideas about trust, expertise, and sharing knowledge. And I think the fundamental thing here is that we need to always be able to be clear and transparent about why children, families, and adults should trust our opinion as social workers.
And then how we can behave with legitimacy and really take that expert role confidently, share it with the adults, families and children we're working with so they take on that mantle of a legitimate expert in their own life, and that we can help all of that knowledge that we have be turned into meaningful action to make difference in people's lives.
It's interesting, actually, because I think for if you use evidence, if you try to be really clear about why you've got why you're making the judgments that you make, if you try to follow an evidence-informed path to making judgments and being able to explain them, then it does increase your confidence, but it also increases your curiosity because there's always more that you can know. So, yeah, those two things I think need to go hand in hand, don't they? Confidence and curiosity.
And I think that that's something that we could have more discussion on after this podcast, actually, in our next little off-piste bit.
Yeah, so our next podcast will be about using evidence, and we'll get into more of the practicalities on that one.
Okay, well, thanks for your time, Jerry. That was really interesting.